This is the spring study weekend at the Victoria Ecclesia. Our speaker is Brother Dennis Bevan from Baltimore, and he will be speaking to us tonight on Thou Art This Head of Gold.
Good evening. Okay, that was the group participation part. I think we'd have this down by now. Good evening. All right, so let's see. Right now, I'm sure many of you, including our presider, thank you for the reading, are wondering, did I just read the wrong chapter? No, I promise there's a reason for reading Jeremiah 36, and it should make sense by the time we are done. Tonight, we are going to look at a story involving a man of faith that was called out by God for a special purpose. A man who went through an awful lot. To give you a quick summary as to where we are in the life of Daniel before we get to chapter 2, we have a person who was ripped out of his home, brought to a foreign land, put in a foreign university to learn about foreign gods and to be assimilated into a foreign people. There were other things involved in this, not quite so pleasant, that we will not distract from, but let's just put it this way. He probably never had children. All of this happened while he was a mid-teenager. So when we put this in perspective, we're looking at a man who, as a very young man, was given a tremendous trial. And yet, as you look at the character of Daniel, it is amazing how he overcomes his circumstance to rise above it and be blessed by God. So today we're going to look at a story that takes place during the 3 years of preparation that are described in Daniel chapter 1. In fact, it would have been about a year into his captivity. And to give us a frame of reference, the reading we just did in Jeremiah 36 takes place in the same year. So now you have back at home in Israel, or I should more specifically in Judah, versus what's going on in Babylon. And so as we had that reading, let's keep some of those thoughts in our mind as we see how the king in Judah behaved when the words of the prophet were brought to him, and contrast them to how the king of Babylon behaves when the words of a prophet are delivered in his midst. So today we're going to focus on both the man and the prophecy. It's one of the most fundamental prophecies in Scripture, and we want to make sure we cover it accordingly. But I want to make sure part of our focus is on this developing character of Daniel as a young man of faith who's going to grow up in tremendous circumstances and yet still be able to stand before the most powerful man of the earth, watching him grow into something that may very well be in the kingdom of our God. So with that being said, we start at Daniel chapter 2, and we'll read the first verse together. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. So this word spirit is the Hebrew word ruach, which is wind or breath. It's the same phrase used in Genesis 41, verse 8, regarding Pharaoh. He obviously goes down to bed considering the future of his kingdom. And we can relate to this to some degree. How many times have we had a dream at night that seemed to be wrestling with the problems we went to bed with? Sometimes we wake up and have a great idea on how to solve those problems. It used to be that I had a piece of paper next to my bed, so if at 3 a.m. I came up with an answer for something I might be struggling at work, I could jot it down before I'd forget it in the morning. Nowadays, I just call myself on my cell phone and leave a voicemail. I'm sure somebody else has to do that. I can't be the only one. Okay, no one's confessing. Got it. Okay, so this is an example to us. Is it's good that we spend the latter part of our evenings either talking to people about the things of the kingdom, perhaps thinking of ourselves the things of the kingdom. Maybe it's our nightly prayers. Maybe it's the readings of the day. Give our God something to work on in our minds overnight so that the things we are thinking of when we go to sleep oftentimes is what fills our dreams. So that being said, we have Nebuchadnezzar now, who's thinking of his kingdom, perhaps his place in the history of the kingdoms of men. The king commanded to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. So standing before the king was the prize offered in chapter 1. If they follow these rules, they will be presented before the king. The word sorcerers in the Hebrew is to practice witchcraft. It's actually used 6 times in the Old Testament, translated witch in Exodus 22, verse 8, where it says, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. So here we have this concept of trying to deceive by the things that we do. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. So now we're going to shift gears, in fact, not just for the dream, but for the next few chapters, from Hebrew to Syriac, which would be Aramaic. The language from chapter 2, verse 4, through chapter 7, is no longer going to be in Hebrew, which means we can no longer throw some Hebrew study notes and look for nuggets in that language. But it is very interesting that Yahweh chooses to record the events affecting the Gentile powers in a common Gentile tongue. These things are not done on accident. They're done to put a focus where God's focus is. And so these men come with what would be a common salutation. O king, live forever. Now, we can see the irony because we kind of know how this story is going to end. But that was a normal thing, to give this accolation to the king, that his reign would extend forever with the blessings of the gods. So the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. Well, that's interesting. So he says, tell me the dream. Then I'll know you have an inclination of what this dream means, which tells us Nebuchadnezzar is tired of being lied to. See, if I tell you the dream, you might be able to spin it in a way that gets my attention. Isn't this really how people can do dream readings now, whether it be dreams or palms or whatever the flavor of the day might be? And you give them just a little information and then, oh, and the next thing you know, they've led you down a path. And as long as he can keep your interest, he can steer your intentions. So the king, who's got these advisors, and he brings them in, tell me what the dream is, that'll validate you know the story. See, it's not forgotten, but withheld. Verse 9 will explain why in just a minute. The reason he does that is to validate their source. If you really do have a connection with the gods of the land, they can help you channel this one. But since he's not so sure that is true, he gives a very graphic punishment, a penalty that says, I will tear you limb from limb, according to the RV, and make your houses a dunghill. I resisted the temptation to clip art a dunghill. That's probably the better of the two picture choices. So verse 6, but if you show the interpretation and, the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. So you can almost picture this as the precursor to a game show. Behind door number 1, no arms and legs and a dunghill. Behind door number 2, honor and riches. Choose wisely. If he wanted a clear answer, he had to be able to buy in to whatever it is they were proclaiming. This is his validation test. He gives them great options, and they're very contrasting. Most of us might be able to relate to some degree at work or at home, but none of us can quite comprehend this great delta between torn from limb to limb and great honor. Maybe in measure, but not exactly to that extent. So at verse 7, they answered again and said, let the king tell his servant the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. It's like, come on. Will you tell us a little, won't you? The king answered and said, I know of a certainty that you would gain the time because, you see, the thing is gone from me. See, even they didn't believe he forgot. If they thought he really forgot, they don't ask again. They're trying to buy time. Give us a little information. That's all we need. If we get a little, we can spin it in a way that'll make you happy. Verse 9, but if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me. Translation, I'm on to you. Time's up. Till the time be changed, therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. Maybe we can buy some time, distract him from his own inquiry. Nope, not this time. This time, I want proof that you have the opportunity to tell the dream and what it really means. 1 Corinthians 1:20 says, hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? And what we're seeing in Nebuchadnezzar now is he's starting to question his own foundations in his nation. Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. That's the first thing these gentlemen have said that was right. There was no man that could do this. The answer was beyond mankind. And by putting it in that realm, they indeed were telling their king, we can't get you that answer. Verse 11, it's a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Isn't that amazing? They're supposed to be his connection to the gods of Babylon. Well, if it can't be done from men, well, ask the gods that you're supposed to be able to call through. This was not a normal situation, as stated in verse 6. There was no time to make something up. They acknowledged that it was beyond them. The problem is the king knew that already. And he's had enough. At verse 12, for this cause the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. No further excuses granted. Time is up. So we have these wise men. In fact, these wise men are referred to 14 times in the story of Daniel. So we can compare the wisdom of the world, as noted as foolishness, with God. He was going to destroy both the learning and the learned. So Daniel, being amongst the learning, was going to be part of that which is destroyed. Remember, in Daniel 1, all these young men from the provinces that Babylon had conquered were being brought in to learn, as we might say, a Chaldean university, to learn the things of the land, and to learn how to be a people like the Chaldeans. Well, if I can't trust the Chaldeans, why do I need more of them? And so not only is it his own advisors, but also those that are being taught by his advisors, the things of the Chaldeans. The advantage Daniel has had up to this point is that he had sufficiently separated himself from the world, as we shall see. And he gets an opportunity to stand before the king, though he has not yet officially earned that right. At verse 14, Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is this decree so hasty from the king? And Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. So this captain of the guard, the margin renders this as the chief of the executioners, or slaughtermen. Now that's interesting. That's the exact same title of Potiphar in the story of Joseph, the chief of the executioners. Now, we have this Potiphar, for example, is a name that means belonging to the sun. The sun god in Egyptian mythology was Ra, And if you notice in the picture ahead, you have this little thing here, that disc. Well, that was an image of the god Ra. And a lot of times in the story, the gods of Egypt, all the gods got Ra added to their name. And you'll see Amun-Ra, for example, and sometimes the king's name, -Ra. And they all were given this little halo, which if you're following back through time, here is where the halo actually begins. Notice what he's holding. He's holding what is called an ankh, which is where the concept of the soul leaving the body comes from. Just short version, at a ceremony called the opening of the mouth ceremony in Egyptian mythology, the mummy was given a little slit where his lips would be, so that in the afterlife, the ka, represented by the ankh, could leave the ba, the body, and go into the afterlife, a separation of body and soul. That's where this concept comes from in Egyptian mythology. Now, why is that relevant? Well, we'll find, if we look at common errors in the world around us, specifically common doctrinal messages that have lost a root from the scripture, actually find a root in Babylon, in Greece, in Rome, and in Egypt. So seeing this connection between Daniel and Joseph, there's a lot there that could be studied, which we will not do that tonight. But there is a ton of connections. We'll pick up a few as we go through. But as we see Joseph as a late teen going before Pharaoh, having the trials to get him to that point, it's not unlike the story of Daniel before Nebuchadnezzar. They were living similar lives with a similar path before similar kings with a similar purpose. At verse 15, Daniel seems unaware of the terms and conditions that led to this decree and the hastiness thereof. This decree of execution, probably because the learned didn't call in the learning and say, hey, we blew it, you're going to die. That they're more worried about their skin and getting time from their king than they are about saving the rest in the kingdom. This is a tragic mistake that can be made. We have to balance experience with current study to maintain the truth. So here we have those with experience trusting in their own wisdom instead of going back to those that are teaching and trying to get current information that might be relevant to the king. There's a little bit of arrogance to this, thinking that, well, we've said no man can handle it. I guess we're just going to die. Verse 16, Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. So this is a different word. It means the appointed time. He is only requesting that he be allowed the time already appointed by the king. He's not asking for an extension. Just give the time that you've originally offered. That is faith. We might compare us and look at the same opportunity when if we were given the same circumstance, how much time would we ask for? I mean, I don't know about you, but if you ever stalled for a little bit more time, maybe trying to squeeze in a homework assignment at the end or something of that nature, there's a deadline at work. Most of us don't get working on it the first day it's assigned. It's right towards the end that we try to cram and hope maybe there's a little bit more time to finish it. But Daniel does not ask for more time. He just says, give me the time allotted. So Daniel went into his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. This is an example of the greatest work in all ecclesial life, because they are going to endure it together. We mentioned this morning that one is too small a number to accomplish anything great. Daniel had a circle of friends, as it's called in chapter 1. His CYC, that we might say. This circle of friends, and he goes to them in their time of need, and they are going to live and endure this together. And so we look around and think, well, you mean one is too small a number? A good example would be this address tonight, because right now you see one person, myself, speaking to a group. But what you may not see, but absolutely must be acknowledged, is the other things that had to take place for this to be possible. There was a coordinating of dates and a location. Someone made a food plan, prepared food, service, cleaning up after the food, accommodations, children's classes in some cases, audio, visual, setup, management of those. Someone had to pay the light bill or we would be in the dark right now. A coordination of activities, music selection and practice. There's a lot going on that makes it possible. The coordination of people working together to serve their God is what ecclesial life is supposed to be. And so Daniel and his three friends give us a very small ecclesia, but nonetheless one dedicated to working together and enduring this trial together. All right, let's look at verse 18. That they would desire the mercies of God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. So we almost can picture this story of Abraham as he's kind of negotiating before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. We have the auction, if you will, where he goes, if there's 50 righteous, how about 45, 40, 30, 20, 10? He stops because he thinks, well, we've got it covered. As we see this same idea, we've got this not willing to perish, but turning it over to God. This is during Gentile darkness. They have been brought away from their land, and the land is in a miserable spiritual state. But yet, they now get to learn individually, once again, that Yahweh delivers. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever. Notice the contrast to the O King, live forever, the reflection of where their perception is. For wisdom and might are his. He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings, he set up both kings. He hath given wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Now we have a public declaration, and this will be repeated again before the king at verse 28. This agrees with the excuses that the learned Chaldean said. No man can do this. Daniel takes no credit for the detail, only credit for serving a God greater than they are accustomed to following. Times and seasons, we've got nature's clock and man's clock. Yahweh is in control of both. Yahweh knows the end from the beginning. He knew that he was not in Babylon by mistake, and that, like Joseph, he'd been brought there for a purpose. He may not have understood that purpose yet, but he knew he wasn't alone. Nebuchadnezzar was not accidentally the king. He did not just by chance take Judah captive. God's hand was at work for the preservation of a few, a calling out of a few for his name. And Daniel has the fortune of being a representative of God to the most powerful man on the planet. Verse 22, he revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, hast made known unto me now what we desired of thee. For thou hast made known unto us the king's matter. God can reveal his way to the fools of this world. Daniel would be a conduit now in this coming verses. But before he does, notice verse 3. Notice the pattern of prayer. They turned to God and asked for help. And we'll see that pattern in all the men and women of faith throughout Scripture. When things get difficult, they turn to God in prayer and ask for help. It's a great exhortation for us. All too often, we tend to rely on our own strength until things get really bad, and then we turn it over to God. If only we could turn it over a little sooner, perhaps we could be delivered with less pain. Verse 24, therefore Daniel went in to Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went in and said unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Note, he wants to take credit for the interpretation. I got it. I can help. Let me come in. He doesn't say he knows what the dream was, by the way, which was the prerequisite. The learned had said knowing the dream was impossible at verse 10. But once they knew it, they could spin it away. Daniel knew he had both the dream, which was the key to him getting an audience, and the meaning, the reason the king couldn't sleep. And Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. And you can almost see this. This is a guy trying to climb up the ladder. I've got the guy. I got you covered, Mr. Nebuchadnezzar. Let me help you out. It was done with a sense of urgency. Remember, there was a whole lot of them condemned to die. So now, if Daniel's wrong, they're all going to die anyways. But if Daniel's right, I want to get in good with the king for being the guy who found him. He wants to get some grace for finding the guy. It was declared impossible, so hey, now I can be elevated. It was entirely true that man could not have an answer. But we'll see in verse 30 that Daniel foils Arioch's plot as well. He's not there for personal glory, nor is he there to provide an opportunity for someone else to be glorified. He is there to show God's glory to the man on the throne. We use that example for us as well as we preach the word of God, thinking of light as that tool. No one hears light, they see light. Daniel is showing how to live according to the law of his God. And who he is going to speak volumes more than what he says. But what he says is going to give him that chance. Verse 26. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? So he addresses him by the name of that he gave him, named after one of the gods of Babylon. Daniel, who by the way his name means, my God is judge, answers in the presence of the king. The secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, musicians, soothsayers, show the king. But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar, what shall be done in the latter days? The dream and the visions of thy head upon thy head are these. So this word God, remember, we're not in Hebrew anymore. It's the same word renders gods in verse 11. Daniel is not preaching Yahweh, but rather declaring, like Paul, the unknown God. There is a God in heaven. Our preaching effort must be paced appropriately. We use the example of the seminars where we start and we build an opportunity to learn piece by piece. And we're going to see, if we read Daniel 3 and 4, we're going to see an example of Nebuchadnezzar who's going to grow a lot in a period of time. From a person who's willing to declare, amongst the gods, your God's okay. He belongs in the pool. To chapter 3, amongst the gods, yours is the most powerful God. Not willing to exclude others, but certainly putting him in the upper crust. And at chapter 4, we have the God is a God of gods that is the most high that rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, it's exclusive. But he doesn't start there. He starts here, and he'll build on it. So he starts with a summary interpretation before commencing within the specifics. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed. What should come to pass hereafter? And he that revealeth secrets maketh known unto thee what should shortly come to pass. By the way, same approach of Joseph before Pharaoh, if you look at Genesis 40 and 41. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes, that you might make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. He's doing something now that is very difficult for human beings to do. He is being both humble and bold at the same time. That's a difficult balance. He's doing Yahweh's glorious work. There's the boldness. But he remains humble in his recognition that he is just a servant. The exhortation to us as well. At verse 31. Now, as I read these verses, I get goosebumps. And the reason we do is because you picture ourselves. Imagine you going before the most powerful person on the planet who said everybody can die for not being able to interpret. and you walk up to this man, and the first thing you say to him about his dream is, "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible or frightening. The history of the kingdom of men was filled even to that day with violence, with corruption." And just citing only Nebuchadnezzar's reign would be enough. Even today's newspaper supports this violence in the kingdoms. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast of arms and silver, his belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, and feet part iron and part clay. And you can almost picture Nebuchadnezzar now going, "Oh, wow." Now you can almost see the amazement on his face. You think he's got the king's attention yet? I know we've all heard this story before, and many of us are probably qualified to speak about this next part, so I'll be quick. But I do want to make a couple simple points. Notice that it is top heavy. Gold is the heaviest of these four metals. Silver carries a lesser value, and verse 39 regards it, this following kingdom, as inferior to Babylon. Brass drops another notch on the value scale. In verse 33, we have iron, even lower in value. And in fact, these values hold up today. If you were to order a fence made in the materials listed, the cost would still be relative. But notice the bottom, the feet part of iron and part of clay. There is an unstable foundation. And any structure with an unstable foundation can be broken by proper timing and the right instrument. "Thou sawest till that stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon its feet of iron and clay and brake them to pieces." So without hands is without human craft or design. Remember, just as no man could give the interpretation and know what the dream was, no man could fulfill this promise that had to be reserved for God. So we have unhewn stone, that which was not shaped by the ways of the flesh. So we compare these two images, if you will, the image that's luminous and shiny and formed of metal versus a stone. Not a pearl, not a gem, but a rock. In Exodus chapter 20, starting at verse 22, we read, "You shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall you make unto me gods of gold. An altar of earth thou shalt make unto me, and thou shalt sacrifice upon thy burnt offerings, thy peace offerings, thy sheep, thine oxen. In all places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. And if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone. For if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it." Direct contrast to the workmen of the gold, silver, brass, and iron. Daniel 2 and 35. "Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor. The wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So in the last days, we have this example of an image standing again, a development of a confederacy, including the same territories. Some wonderful ties to Ezekiel 38 for another night. The threshing floor is a nice piece to tie into the heap of sheaves in a valley for judgment, which would be the definition of Armageddon. The kingdom begins to grow to a point where the earth is filled with the glory of Yahweh. That's the intended message. In Matthew 21:42, Jesus saith unto them, "Do you never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner? This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." So we have no doubt as to what this stone referred to. So Daniel continues. "This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king." And you know, sometimes what's not said is as powerful as what is said. Nebuchadnezzar is speechless. He doesn't stop. He doesn't interrupt. He's letting this poor captive stand before him and talk. And what does he say? "Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, strength, and glory." He's skirting it a little bit now. Now we're going to get pretty direct. As others stand before him and say, "O king, live forever." Well, you've got a kingdom, all right. But it's only because God has given you that kingdom, that power, that strength, and that glory. He's consistently reminding that even his very appointment as king was administered by this all-powerful God in heaven. Daniel, the one who was supposed to be educated in the ways of the Chaldeans, is about to educate the king of these Chaldeans. And the next couple chapters reveal a glorious ending. Verse 38. "Wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of heaven, hath he given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold." It's almost exactly a repeat if we look in at the order of Genesis 1 and 28, if you want to tie it back to Genesis again. We have the beasts and the birds. We have the nations and people. They'll come up again in Daniel chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar was the model of human pride and power. His 43-year reign was over half of the 70 years that Judah was captive in Babylon. The next chapter shows that this was not quite enough for him. In fact, in the next chapter, he builds an image all of gold. So he's satisfied with being the head of gold, the most powerful and most valuable metal in the mix. What he's not satisfied is the rest of this verse. Verse 39. "After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass that shall rule over all the earth." Not inferior in size or even territory, but certainly inferior commanding in power. If you line up these verses with chapter 7, the ram and the he-goat of chapter 8, the beast in chapter 7, sorry, the ram and the he-goat of chapter 8, which is beyond the scope of what we'll do tonight, we know this to be the Medes and the Persians followed by the Greeks. You know, an interesting story, just as an aside note, as he's talking to him and says, "Your kingdom's going to end." That is a powerful message in and of itself. The kingdom of yours will end. You know, it's an interesting story. I'll take a small detour about how the kingdom of Babylon ended. I am always fascinated at how God works with the kingdoms of this world and how some subtle things can change the course of history. I think that's our opportunity to see God's hand at work. And at a key point when Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians, is marching into Babylon, there is a passageway through Syria that has mountains on both sides. And they're going to go straight through the valley on their way to conquer Babylon. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is long dead, but his line is still on the throne. And when they go through this valley, it's a prime place for an ambush. And Cyrus has one of his advisors comes to him and says, "You know, if we put the baggage camels in front, if the Babylonians know we're coming and they come down the hill, we might lose all our stuff, but we can escape out the back and limp home." Cyrus figured that makes some sense. Go ahead. Well, Babylon did know they were coming. And the riders on the hills came down in an ambush formation to destroy Cyrus and his army, which would have, in effect, destroyed the image as promised in Daniel's prophecy. But the smell of the baggage camels from Persia was so foreign and so foul that it threw the riders. And in hand-to-hand combat, Cyrus and his men defeated the army of Babylon in that valley in Syria and continued their journey, eventually conquering and ridding the head of gold to make room for the chest and arms of silver. If not for the smell of a baggage camel, God's plan might crumble. The fact that something so seemingly insignificant could be the linchpin in God's delivering his promise shows us that there is a far more powerful being than any man on any throne in the history of mankind. Verse 40. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, forasmuch as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things. Iron that breaketh all these, it shall break in pieces and bruise. So this kingdom gives us a little room for debate. Daniel calls out by name Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. We don't have a specific name for the kingdom of iron. However, it was the next seceding kingdom in the history of mankind is Rome. Iron is used repeatedly in the book of Revelation by John to show the description of a beast we can historically match to Rome. So we can see without a shadow of a doubt the first three, and with very strong inference the next one, the fourth one. Verse 41, whereas thou hast saw the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay, part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of strength of iron, forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with clay. As the toes of the feet were part of the iron, part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. So we have a kingdom without unity, but a semblance of that unity. Does that in any way describe Europe today? The remnants of the two-footed Roman Empire still exist politically and religiously. Verse 43. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. In the days of these kings, so the divided nations with assembly of unity, perhaps in our day, the God of heaven shall set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. And it, that kingdom, shall stand forever. He's talking about the last days. There's no more shaping, no more forming, but a divine kingdom to be established, which is where our hope comes into play. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. The dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof is sure. Reminder, in summary, the interpretation is sure. He gives them the key. Here is your dream. There's the key. Now the interpretation is sure. Because the same God that allowed me to tell you your dream was the same one that gave you the interpretation. And it is without condition. Verse 46 is a remarkable response. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors to him. Can you picture the scene now? The king of the most powerful empire in the world bowing to a Hebrew teenaged slave. Not just a Hebrew teenage slave, but one who's not even trying to receive honor or glory. This was not a look at me moment. This was an opportunity for Nebuchadnezzar to begin a story of humility. Oh, it's going to be a long journey, and he's got a long ways to go. But this was the first step. Nebuchadnezzar still sees Daniel as the source, and he, even against the words that Daniel gives him, he wants to give him honor, same as we see in the story of Joseph before Pharaoh. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings, a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. Note, the king answered. These are his words. Your God is a God of gods, a Lord of kings. He sees in this a greater power than man, at least, which was really Daniel's initial objective. Nebuchadnezzar is now ready to acknowledge the God of Daniel. Therefore, Judah, the God of Daniel and the God of Judah, therefore, as one of the gods, amongst the gods. He's not the God or the top God, but in the bowl of gods, he's in the mix. He's not the only ingredient. Now, we mentioned earlier that the Jeremiah 36 took place in the same year as this dream. Jeremiah 36, verses 22 and 23. The king, and now where the king of Judah sits at the winter house in the ninth month, there was a fire on the hearth burning before him. And it came to pass that when Jehudi had read three or four leaves, he cut it with the penknife and cast it into the fire that was on the hearth until the roll was consumed in the fire that was on the hearth. Can you imagine after reading part of the Bible that you didn't particularly like because it condemned your own behavior, cutting it to shreds and throwing it into a fireplace? But that's exactly what Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, did. While this Jewish king in the line of David was burning God's word and punishing the servant of God, in the same year, a pagan king was praising the name of God and rewarding his servant. How different those two outcomes were. We're going to see, if we continue reading the story, well, Jehoiakim, how'd he end up? He received the burial of an ass, and he was considered under the law by doing so as unredeemable. Where on the other side, the pagan king Nebuchadnezzar continues to grow and has the opportunity under inspiration to write Daniel chapter 4 as a first-person account and a confession of his faith. Our God rules the kingdom of men and sets over it whomsoever he will. That was the message that Nebuchadnezzar learned in the end. Verse 48 of Daniel chapter 2. Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Then Daniel requested of the king that he set Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, the same three people he talked to, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, those are the Hebrew names, these are the Chaldean names. These same circle of friends, he asked that they would be put over the affairs in the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Nebuchadnezzar kept his promise from verse 6, and even the friends of Daniel were elevated, much like we can be elevated together in that day, if we can stand before our ruler and judge, and band as one against the world around us. That's the hope that we share, as exemplified in the story of Daniel. And to that, we look forward to that day when we might as one be united before the most powerful man on the planet. And to that we say, even so, come, Lord Jesus.